I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Paul Wilcox joins me again. He's got a new book out. It's a terrific collection of 40 crimes from the province's past, some solved, many unsolved. It's a good sketch of the kind of greed, depravity, and desperation that's happened throughout British Columbia's history. The book is called Dead Ends, BC Crime Stories. I'll get Mr. Wilcox to tell us about some of the stories therein. Notable crimes like the Olson and Picton cases are in here, as well as the kidnapping of Jim Pattison's daughter, the NHL's Marty McSorley's assault on Donald Brashear, and the sex scandal that surrounded Socred Cabinet Minister Bob McClellan. These are just a few of what one can read about in the book. There's a lot in here, and we'll talk about some of the stories that really define British Columbia. They're stories we shouldn't forget. Paul Wilcox is a distinguished journalist who's won many awards, including a Michener Award and the Jack Webster City Mike Award. The website for more is at paulwilcox.com. Dead Ends is published by the University of Regina Press. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in Victoria, Paul Wilcox. Mr. Wilcox, good morning.
Good afternoon, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
It's been a while since you've been on. I guess you've been busy.
Yeah, we've been traveling a bit. We were down in Honduras for a little more than 2 years. My partner and I were on CUSO International Placements doing work with development agencies, Honduran development agencies, trying to contribute the skills we have to their progress. So it's been a long time since we've talked about BC politics, I think.
Yeah, and so this time we're talking about BC crime stories.
Very fine line between BC politics and BC crime, some would say.
There's a lot in here. So I guess to set the goalposts in terms of the time that's covered, it's about 150 years plus, right?
Yeah, we pretty much go from the 1860s to today. The challenge was to pick 40 crimes that were interesting. That part was easy because crimes generally tend to be interesting. But then once I got more into the process, you start to look for crimes that also, or at least the crimes step out as saying how much they reveal about the people we were in British Columbia and the people we are today. I expected them to be really, really good stories because, I mean, we're all interested. You turn on the television and crime dramas are hugely popular. We're interested in crime and criminals and their adventures and misadventures. But even as I started researching, I was quite intrigued by how much the crimes spoke out to us about sort of the issues that really drove our evolution as a province and as a society.
Now, how does BC rate in terms of how much crime there is to say other provinces or states with similar sizes and population?
Well, we generally tend to be in the middle of the pack. What I did find when I started researching this was we seem to attract, or seem to have, and this is anecdotal. It's hard to measure some of these things. More of the flamboyant con men, the people like Christopher Rocancourt, the originally from France, who sort of cut a swath through the United States with his con man schemes, and then landed in Whistler and portrayed himself as a Formula One driver for Ferrari, which, you know, it's the kind of thing where if anyone had taken a moment to check, they would have seen that was impossible, but nobody did. And, you know, Ian Thau over here in Victoria, so we certainly had those kinds of criminals. The other kind that really emerged when I was doing the book were the crimes that related to the early years of the province and the later years too, sadly, and our relations with the First Nations, the conflicts between the settlers, the entrepreneurs, the investors, and the people who are already living here. And that, I think that's more striking in British Columbia than it is in some other parts of the country because we didn't do treaties here.
Yeah, and so race and other discrimination, I mean, that certainly, you have those in amongst the 40 stories that you talk about in the book.
It's a remarkable theme, I thought, going from, you know, going back to the 1860s and the Chilcotin War and the hanging of Kotsafin and five other Chilcotin leaders after a summer-long, I mean, it was genuinely a war, I think. It was more of a guerrilla war from the Chilcotin side, but you know, we had about 25 people who were killed in the course of the summer. A huge response from the colonial governments to try and put down the uprising or the defense of Chilcotin territories, depending on how you characterize it. So, I mean, there was that kind of crime, and then you got into uh, I was I sort of vaguely knew about the case of Janet Smith in Vancouver in 1924, a young Scottish nursemaid who mysteriously is killed by a single shot to the head as she's ironing in the basement of a Point Grey mansion. And this sort of, not necessarily the suspect, but the immediate attention all turned to the Chinese servant who was working in the house again at the same time, a young man named Wong Fun Sing. And I mean, he was actually kidnapped by, not by the police directly, but by agents of the police, and held for 6 weeks as they tried to either get a confession or get information out of him. So there was sort of a casual racism that persisted for quite a long time in this province.
The Smith case, which you've just mentioned, as well as other crimes such as the Picton case and the Air India bombings, those have had book-length tellings already. But they're included here because these are big stories in the province's history, aren't they?
Yes, that's exactly right. We've got 40 crimes in the book, and we're trying to give a pretty broad sampling of the regions and the times. And there were some cases that, I mean, Picton's a really good example. I struggled with that because on one hand it needs to be in the book. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you say, what more is there to say, and how much more do people need to hear about such a horrific chapter in the life of our province? And so I did sort of wrestle with that one, and the way, and that chapter really deals very, very little with Robert Picton and really tells the story of just an absolutely extraordinary family in Campbell River. And their daughter and the chapter starts with her as a young girl, you know, living a completely normal life in Campbell River, fishing with her father, raising her pet rabbits. She falls into drugs, falls into the streets, falls into prostitution, goes to Vancouver, disappears. Marnie Frey is her name. And her father and her stepmother, an extraordinary woman named Marlene Frey, are simply not prepared to let her be forgotten. And Marlene, they try and complain to the police that she's disappeared. The police say, well, she's a sex worker and an addict. They disappear, and you know, we're not really, at first, not even willing to take a missing persons report. Marnie went over to the downtown east side, repeatedly talked to sex workers on the street, addicts on the street, the workers who were supporting them, and she learned that there was a man named Willie or Robert, a pig farmer, who was taking women away, and they were never seen again. And she learned that he had a wood chipper, and she actually went out to his property and sort of clung to the fence late at night, trying to peer in to see what she could see. But she could never convince the police or anyone else to take her complaints seriously. And so the chapter becomes about them, and I guess that's why I think the book, for me, went beyond just interesting and into important. I mean, the reason that Robert Picton could kill 50-plus women, and we don't have any idea really how many he killed, was because we didn't care about those women. And you can't blame the police. You can't blame the lack of coordination in the departments in the Lower Mainland. Really, they were just prey because, as a society, we just decided they didn't matter very much. So I think those stories are important to tell.
Yeah, and you do see this, sort of how BC changes over the years, because these crimes, obviously, they make the news. They affect a number of people. And writ large, they affect society, don't they?
I mean, they do, and they really reflect society. I mean, that's,
yeah.
And that's one of the things I found really interesting was what were once, I mean, some of the crimes, especially the historical ones, you look at them and they probably would not be crimes today. The Chilcotin were, for example, resisting incursions into their territory. So, I mean, that one started in the early 1860s. With a plan to build a road from the Butte Inlet into the Cariboo Goldfields through the unceded territory of Chilcotin. And it was a sort of harebrained scheme by a Victoria entrepreneur, a man who'd come up from San Francisco, Alfred Waddington, and thought he could make money by building a toll road. It's completely impossible. The geography was impossible. Everything about it was impossible. But he raised money from scores of investors and promised huge returns, won colonial government support vaguely for the idea. But once his road crews were up there trying to cut this road through, they inevitably came into conflict with Chilcotin. The backdrop to that was also the smallpox epidemics, which mm-hmm. were so devastating to First Nations people, and they were terrified of that being introduced into their communities. So, you know, the whole resistance probably wouldn't be even considered a crime today. And then on the other hand, some of them swing, the pendulum swings in the opposite direction. You mentioned the Bob McClelland, mm-hmm. Social Credit Cabinet Minister here in Victoria, and he was caught up in a completely crazy police Crown Prosecutor operation in 1985 to target an escort agency in Victoria. Lord knows why they got this particular escort agency as a bee in their bonnet, but they sort of stretched the very, very limits of the privacy laws and staged this very, very expensive campaign to crack down on this escort agency. And Bob McClelland, cabinet minister, the night before he was to be sworn into a new cabinet job, had a little too much to drink, feeling a little lonely perhaps in his hotel room in Victoria. He lives in the Lower Mainland, calls up the escort agency and asks for a woman to be sent to his room, and his credit card receipt shows up when the police raid the place and gather the information, and he's called as a witness for the defense. But what was interesting, so we're talking 1985, prostitution, actually the actual sex trade wasn't illegal then, though most of the things around it, living off the avails, running a body house, were, which is what they call charge the manager of the escort agency with. But Bob McClelland goes to court and says, yes, I paid $130, I had a woman come to my room, we had sex. And obviously, he's not very happy about this experience as a married man. But Premier Bill Bennett, and we're talking about theoretically a more conservative time, mm-hmm. doesn't drop him from cabinet. He's obviously not happy, but the position was then, it's not against the law. I wish he hadn't done it, but it's not affecting his job. And now we flash forward to today, where the current conservative government says people like Bob McClelland are perverts. And wants to make it a criminal offense to do what he did back then. So, you know, our definition of crime is very, very fluid, I guess, over the years.
Yeah. Who was the last man hanged in British Columbia?
That's another one that really talks about our society. It was Leo Mansa, he was Quebec-born, kind of a tough-looking guy. He'd been in the Navy. It hadn't really worked out. He'd been discharged. He was living here in Victoria. And he slit the throat of his lover, which in 1958, Canada was, we didn't really want capital punishment anymore, mm-hmm. Or the government didn't really want capital punishment anymore, but they were afraid of a political backlash if they got rid of capital punishment. So what they were doing was routinely commuting most death sentences to life in prison, especially if it was a crime of passion, as this one clearly was. So no doubt Leo Mansa did it. He was convicted. The judge, the BC Supreme Court judge, immediately, in fact, Judge Hutchinson, who was the son of the same journalist, Bruce Hutchinson, mm-hmm. immediately sent a telegraph to Ottawa, because that's the way people communicated at that time, saying, you should commute this sentence to life imprisonment. He shouldn't go to the gallows. It was a crime of passion. He's not going to kill anyone else. This is a textbook case for not hanging him. But the difference in this case was that Leo Mansa was gay. The lover that he killed was a man who was still in the Navy, and Leo Mansa had snuck into the barracks at CFB Esquimalt in the night and slashed his throat. And there are a lot of questions about how he was able to do that. And the Navy's immediate reaction was to say it was a suicide, which, you know, made obviously no sense at all. But in any case, both the judge and the prosecutor said later that it was pretty clear to them that the reason his sentence wasn't commuted was because that this was a homosexual relationship, and it was viewed differently by the government of the day. And you can't say that he was hanged because he was homosexual, but if he hadn't been, he would not have been hanged. He did the crime, for sure, but his sexual orientation played a huge part in the fact that he went off to Ocala prison, had a T-bone steak, sat down with the priest for a period of time the night before, and then they converted an elevator shaft into the gallows there, and he was the last person to stand on the trap door with the hood over his head and fall to his death.
I was in a restaurant not too long ago. I was going to say White Spot, but I don't think it's White Spot. I think it's The Keg. And in, on the menu, you can order Billy Miner pie. And
yeah,
is it the keg?
I think it is the keg.
Yeah. And so, it's, I mean, we've sort of known the name over the years. But in the book, we find out who he is.
Yeah, and he's and that's another one, classic one, where we sort of, we have a real fascination with outlaws. I think. We have from Bill Miner back in the early days of the last century to people like Stephen Reed, even over here in Victoria, who's also in the book. I mean, Bill Miner was a fascinating, again, guy who grew up in the East, moved to the West when it was still the Wild West, and took up stagecoach robbing. That was going to be his career, and then he graduated to train robbery as the stagecoaches gradually faded away, and we moved to the new technology of the more modern era. And he had a lot of style. I think that's part of the reason that people are so fascinated with him. He was, in one of his really early robberies, he stuck up a clothing store clerk. He wanted to get a better outfit, and but at the same time, he left the clothing store clerk with his watch and said, you know, I don't want to take this. You'll need this. It looks like your mom gave it to you or something. It's quite valuable. So he went through his whole career like that as a gentleman robber, bought fine clothes when he had money. He was also incredibly incompetent. I mean, that's the other thing that you're struck with some of these stories. The image that I had of Bill Miner was this really successful, lifelong criminal. In fact, he spent almost all his life in San Quentin. He'd do a robbery, get caught, get sent away for 4 or 5 years, do a robbery, get caught, spend another 7 or 8 years in San Quentin, which was a horrific place at that time. But eventually he made his way up to British Columbia, robbed the Canadian Pacific Railway train outside Vancouver. Now it's just sort of in the Upper Fraser Valley, and became kind of a folk hero for doing that. One of the jokes at the time was, why were people getting so excited? Because Billy Miner had just robbed the CP Rail once, and the CP Rail was robbing the people of British Columbia every day. There's so much enmity towards the railways. But he was one of those dramatic figures. Broke out of jail again once he was caught and sentenced for his jail robbery in British Columbia, perhaps with the help of officials. That part's not clear. And then took on the lands in the United States, but. Yeah, he's the classic outlaw hero, the kind of guy that even when he was arrested and put into jail, he had been living around Princeton, helping out on farms and things like that, and people up there had nothing but good things to say about him and complained to the newspapers about him being arrested.
Now, there, as I mentioned in the introduction, there are a number of cases that are unresolved. Looking back at them again and reading everything that you could on them as you were writing this book, did you play detective at all? Did you get a sense in your own mind as to what happened and perhaps solve the Janet Smith murder or something like that?
No, the Janet Smith murder, it's a classic because there are so many people who could have done it. So that's the Scottish housemaid living in the home of a rich couple in Point Grey. And part of that, we're talking about sort of early 1920s Vancouver when there are big issues of class. There is a very rich, high society class. There's a lot of people struggling. And there was also crazy newspaper wars going on then. So that following the murder, there was immediate speculation of all kinds about wild drug parties in the house, whether the husband, the owner of the house, had killed her, one of some of his friends had been over for a drug or drunken party and killed her, whether the Wong Fung Sing, the Chinese servant had. And that one, I've read it all, and there's been some good books done on it and went back to the original material, and you simply end up going, that's a total mystery. There's a few troubled ones. One of the ones is there was a young woman named Marguerite Telford here in Victoria, and in 1987 she went out for a jog in the morning, which was something she did fairly regularly. She was living with her foster parents, going to the University of Victoria, and she just never came back. Her body was never found, and they eventually convicted kind of a likely suspect, a very, very unlikable man named Scott McKay, who had a previous record for serious sexual assault. But he was convicted pretty much entirely on one hair sample that was found weeks later under his trunk, and the testimony of a lot of other inmates at Wilkinson Jail here who said he confessed to the crime, but they all received benefits from the Crown Prosecutor for their testimony. So it's one of those ones where you go, he was undoubtedly a very bad man, but if you look at that case and you think, I wonder if he'd had a better lawyer, whether there wouldn't have been any chance of convicting him, and you wonder how such a bungler could have got away with hiding a body in such a way that it would never be found.
Yeah. It's, you do a wonderful job at the back, too, in terms of citing your sources. So there are, if we want to do more reading, we can certainly pick up some of the material that you sought in the course of writing this book, right?
Yes, and there are some tremendous resources. There's some especially great work done by, for a couple of the cases, the Peter Berrigan, the bombing of the Dukhobor leader, they blew up his train car, killed him and seven other people in 1924 he's on the Kettle Valley Railway. There's rifts within the Dukhobor community. There's suspicions that other people wanted Peter Berrigan done dead. But it's a very early act of assassination or terrorism where this bomb just rips through this train car in the night. And kills these people. And the University of Victoria has done some great, great resources, which are in the back of the book, that has all the original documents, the coroner's reports, the police reports, so you can go through them yourself and try and understand the crime and try and understand the time as well.
In the acknowledgments of the book, you talk about the importance of newspapers. You mentioned that newspaper reporters and editors across BC since 1858 have done, the first draft of history, reporting on events and society's attitudes. Am I reading too much into it in terms of perhaps how you might feel about the importance and, say, the survival of newspapers in our world today?
No, I think you're very astute to have noticed that. I was certainly conscious of, what looks very much like the impending demise of most or many of the newspapers that have been around for such a long time. And I'm not a historian, right? I've been a journalist, and I guess one of the things I was struck by in doing this project was how many gaps there were in my knowledge. And newspapers were, as I went back to research, an important part of trying to gather this information. They were, of course, far from perfect. There were conflicts in the stories, there were obvious misspellings of names, there were basic facts that were wrong, but what they really captured was how their communities were responding to these events and what was being said about these crimes when they happened. It was so vivid. It was so vivid to go back and read, for example, when there's a First Nations, a charismatic First Nations sort of businessman, community leader, Gunanut, who again probably killed one or two people after a night of drinking, justified or not justified, in 1906. And he took off into the wilderness with his family and just was a fugitive for 13 years. But when you read the newspapers, there was a grudging respect for him and for what he had been able to do, and that the sense that his crime was justified. But B, more striking for me was it reminded me that we're talking about 1910, 1915, well into the 20th century. The newspaper reports made it clear that people were very, very nervous, not just that he was a criminal, but that by being free, he could become the kind of leader who would rally First Nations people at a time when they still came close to outnumbering settlers in much of the interior. So the papers painted that kind of vivid picture. And I am, obviously, they say it's very, very challenging times, with no disrespect to the huge number of other ways that news is being covered these days, bloggers. There's just an array of great sources. We're at risk of losing something that has been really important in doing that sort of rough first draft that, even if it's not always 100% accurate, really captures the tone and the sentiment of the time.
Indeed, yeah. I follow the work that you and your partner Jody Patterson do online on her blog, as well as updates on Facebook that you do. But would you tell people listening some of the work that you've been doing the last couple of years and the next few months, what that'll involve?
No, happily. We've both been managers and journalists and communications people here in Canada. And in 2011, we both thought we were at a stage where it would be interesting to try something sort of new and bold. And there's an organization in Canada called CUSO International, which if people haven't heard of it, they should go online and look it up. And CUSO's mandate is to identify or provide the opportunity for people, mostly Canadians, some from other countries, with skills and experience, to take those skills and experience and lend them to contribute with development agencies in countries around the world, from Africa, Asia, to Central America. So we looked at the opportunities that were available there, and we spent 2012 and 2013 in Honduras, living in Copan Ruinas, a nice little town, actually, working, trying to help Honduran development agencies with communications and management strategy kinds of issues. Hugely challenging, hugely fascinating. Honduras was, when you want to talk about crime, Colombia looks like a total amateur compared to Honduras. They have, the murder rate is the highest in the world, and it's a country of about 8.5 million people, and on a typical day, there are 18, 19 murders across the country, not involving tourists or visitors. People should still go. It's Hondurans who pay the price for this kind of violence. So we did that work. We had a fabulous time. We've been back since April, sort of working, finishing on the book, doing other projects here. And on Saturday, we're going down to Nicaragua for similar kinds of projects with CUSO once again, much shorter term this time, probably 4 or 5 months, but working on, I'm going to be working on a project with an organization of exporters to try and find export markets for co-ops and small producers in Nicaragua. But it's for anybody who's sort of interested in international experience and is able to take the step. CUSO has some wonderful, wonderful opportunities. And they call it volunteering, but it's not really. You're paid a stipend that's the equivalent of the wage in the country to which you are going. And that's more than adequate to break even for your 6 months or 2 years or whatever it is assignment.
Now, I'm assuming, having lived there for the last couple of years, that your Spanish has improved a great deal. Is that right?
It's improved a great deal, but that was one of the, I mean, there were so many interesting things about the experience, and one was certainly working in a new language, right? It was very, very challenging, especially for the first 12 to 14 months as you, I think like most of us, and certainly like you, you get very confident and confident in your ability to function in a meeting, to do an interview like this one, to know that even if you aren't necessarily an expert, you can contribute. And it was very challenging to go down and sit in a meeting of 15 people and realize that probably you were the one who was least able to contribute, and I had to really work as hard as I could to make up for that in other ways.
I've read with interest Jody's blog posts on these orphans that you worked with, that you cared for, and the sort. I mean, these last couple of years away, having been away from British Columbia as you have, what did you learn about people that you didn't know before?
That's a very, very good and very, very difficult question. I think there were some striking things, to be sure. I mean, Honduras is dirt poor. About half the people live in, or about 75% of people live in poverty, and about half live in fairly extreme poverty. And then, you know, those statistics can be a little bit misleading, because if you have a little patch of land, you can still grow corn and beans for tortillas and beans, and that's sort of the basis of the diet. But it's a very, very difficult life. We were both struck when we came back by the fact that, and I don't want to romanticize the sort of, oh, they're poor but happy, because I'm not sure they have the same anxiety about their future, but it was a much friendlier experience walking down the street in Copan, or even in the larger cities in Honduras, which are a little bit dangerous, than it is walking down the street in Victoria. And, and Vancouver, people inevitably made eye contact and said hello. If you knew them at all, it was sort of mandatory to stop and have at least a little bit of a conversation. There was a certain level of social engagement, superficial to be sure, but that we have somehow fallen away from here in British Columbia. Jody had an interesting conversation on a long drive with one of her Honduran co-workers, and who was genuinely puzzled about why people in North America use drugs. I mean, Honduras is a major transshipment center for the cocaine that's moving its way from South America to the North American market. And this person was baffled by why people who, from his perspective, had so much opportunity, had so much material goods, had access to good education, somehow found the need to use drugs while people in Honduras were sort of just slogging along without becoming addicted or even using alcohol for the most part.
It's fascinating. I mean, to be part of a conversation like that would have just been remarkable.
It was, and that's where getting truly comfortable in Spanish. I mean, it took a very, very long time to even begin having those conversations, because once you get into anything sort of subtle or personal, it's much more difficult.
Paul, all the best to you and Jody with your work ahead, and congratulations on this book. It's such a great read.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, incidentally, because I just realized you've been on the program the last 9 years or so. You're always one of my favorite guests, and I've missed you over the last few years. So, but we still keep in touch on Facebook. But thank you for all your appearances over the years. I truly appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for the chance, and I look forward to doing it again.
Indeed. PaulWilcox.com is the website for more. The book is called Dead Ends, BC Crime Stories. It's from University of Regina Press. Do pick it up. It's a great read. It'll keep you up at night, but it's just fascinating to learn about the people in BC, the people involved in these stories, but you also learn something about British Columbia reading it and finding about who we are and what we've become. Paul Wilcox joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.